Yes, I'm Kyung Ryu from IBM TJ Watson Research Center. And today I'll talk about our infrastructure as a service we developed and called RC2, Research Compute Cloud. And this was designed to provide a cloud computing environment for all the IBM researchers worldwide. This paper, I think, should be a strong candidate for most co-authored paper award, if there is such a thing. We have like 17 authors here. And this is the first time, actually, I wrote a paper with this many authors. Half of them are scientists and half of them are developers. By the way, it is true that there are the papers from IBM with more authors. Those are the ones regarding the BlueJIN supercomputer. So why do we need this for the researchers? Like, the IBM has lots of researchers worldwide. We have more than 3,000 researchers, and half of them are PhDs. And actually, we have 9 labs worldwide. We have 3 research centers in the U.S., TJ Watson Research in New York, and Armadale Lab, which is just several miles away from here. And there is a small one in Austin. And there are 3 labs in Asia, Beijing in China, India, and Tokyo. And then we have 1 in Zurich, and another 1 in Middle East, Haifa, in Israel. And I just said 9 labs, and I showed only 8 labs. And there is 1 newly created in South America. So we are actually getting a new research lab in São Paulo, Brazil. However, we have only 2 employees now, so I didn't put it here yet. So lots of researchers are working on various things, and half of them, and more than half of them, working in computer science. And then there are lots of machine rooms in each of these sites. And in these machine rooms, many, many machines are bought every year, and maybe heavily used for maybe a few years. And they are just sitting and getting dusted because they are not the most advanced machines anymore, and it's less interesting for research. However, they are still very strong machines, and there is no way you can ship around these machines for different purposes. So internally, we need some kind of a place, infrastructure to enable cloud computing. And at the same time, about half of these computer science researchers are working on cloud computing, actually. So we are working hard to enable some technologies to deliver the cloud computing to our customers. And we need some kind of playground. Okay, there's only so much we can do with Amazon EC2. So we need our own playground, which is more realistic. And when you look at this geographical distribution of labs, this is actually miniature of worldwide public users. Right, they are very well geographically distributed. And the machine labs are also distributed over. And we have data centers all over the world. So, we got some mission impossible, or maybe not impossible, we think. We try to chase the 2 rabbits and catch both, hoping there is not none. First, we want to come up with a commercial-grade infrastructure as a service for semi-public cloud. I said semi-public cloud because this is not the public cloud anybody can access and use using your credit card. However, within IBM, it's kind of public cloud. Anybody in the IBM with their own ID, they can tap into this cloud and use the resources there. At the same time, this also should be the playground for the quick cloud technology adoption and experiments. And you can see that these 2 goals can be quite conflicting with each other, right? You want to have a very solid commercial grade, so you don't want to say like, oops, something happened, you lost whatever you have done. You don't want to do that. But at the same time, you try to adopt the early technologies. So this is a challenge for us. And there is another challenge, which is unique to IBM, and which doesn't exist with the Amazon EC2 or Rackspace infrastructure as a service. IBM makes and sells lots of Intel-based Linux servers like others, but IBM also makes lots of high-end servers based on power and running AX instead of Linux. Also, we still sell a lot of mainframe, whether you believe it or not. It's still bringing a lot of profits to us. And there's a gentleman who from the Wells Fargo mentioned about this mainframe. Mainframe, the virtualization is native. And you should be able to allocate as much resources you want and create a, run your own operating system in mainframe. So the goal is we have to come up with infrastructure service to support all these three different kind of servers running different kind of hypervisors. So this is just a simplified architecture of our research compute cloud software solution. And basically, you see the this is divided in two pieces in the top and bottom. On the top, we have something called the cloud dispatcher. This cloud dispatcher is in charge of getting all the requests from the users. For example, you want to create a one VM instance from the Power series, or maybe one from one Linux from the X series. And then it understands that request and then sending it down to the relevant component managers. And I'm showing this several component managers underneath, and they can be run independently on remote node. And they can be in multiple instances. And we can provide HA, high availability features, by having primary and secondary underneath, and then requests can be redirected based on the failure status from the dispatcher. That's the reason we want to have a dispatcher. Also, you can see the matching proxy inside the dispatcher. This is the way we provide the abstraction layer for the cloud request. So the abstraction provides a very well-defined APIs for the all cloud operations. And these APIs are common, independent of the platforms of machines you want to use. At the same time, implementation of these component managers can be switched with a more advanced one if somebody come up with a new one. Okay? And this should not affect the way the cloud is used by the users. So let me just go through the important component managers we have here. The user managers basically authenticate the users and they maintain the account information of the users. And then image manager is the one who maintain the image repository. So if you understand the virtual machine, you can take a snapshot and make it as an image, and you can archive it anywhere you want. You can bring it back up and create a VM instance out of it anytime you want. And the instance manager is actually the component which takes the image from the image manager and then talk to the hypervisor to create the virtual machine instance. And the last one, but not the least, is the security manager. And as you know, I mean, security is a big concern in cloud computing. And I'm not going to claim that our security manager will solve all those problems, but it actually adds some features to harden the virtual machine instances when there are other virtual machines from other companies that are running at the same time. So in the following slides, I will give you brief explanation about the dispatcher and some of those component managers. And with the 30 minutes given, there's no way I can talk about all the details. And as you know, there are 17 authors with lots of work done here. So this is just one example of a physical layout of that logical architecture I've shown before. So the idea here is that we can group any pieces of those components shown before and put into the a set of physical machines. You can put all of them into the one machine, but which may not be really realistic when you handle thousands of virtual machines. So in this case, some of them grouped in one machine. For example, cloud dispatcher and image manager and user manager are sitting on the same box, but some other components are sitting on the different boxes. Okay. Okay. So Let me talk about the cloud dispatcher first. And maybe I will talk a little bit more details about this dispatcher because this is what I worked on. And all other components, I'm not necessarily the expert. So maybe this is unfair, but I came here to give a presentation, right? So what do you want to achieve through this cloud dispatcher? And the most important thing, role this dispatcher is taking is to handle the impedance mismatch between the user request and the capacity of the backend component managers, right? So what I'm saying is here is that the image manager can handle only certain amount of requests given time period. I'll give you another example. Instance manager, for some reason, can create up to 256 instances at the same time. If there are more requests coming in and admitted, it can crash that component, or it can overload that component so everything will get slowed down. Okay? So the cloud dispatcher should actually prevent that kind of cases, and I will show how it does that. Also, when you look at all the cloud operations, there are lightweight ones and there are heavyweight ones. The lightweight ones includes you just query about your image. For example, I'd like to know the owner of this image and what kind of softwares are installed there. So internally, in this infrastructure, that's just a simple database lookup, right? But on the other hand, the request to create a one VM instance or capturing one image takes long, long time. It takes minutes, right? And these different types of requests should be handled differently. So this is some detailed diagram of a cloud dispatcher. Maybe I put too much details here. But basically, the dispatcher is in the middle piece and sitting between the REST servlet handler and cloud manager. REST servlet is running because we provide our cloud operation API through the REST interface, okay? And the servlet on top actually handles that, but we don't let that servlet thread just handle and send the request down to the components directly. Actually, we insert the queue between the servlet handler and the ones who process the request and move it down to the corresponding component handler. And I will describe why we put the queue and what does this queue do. So our smart dispatcher, I call it smart because it does some intelligent things. I'll describe it later, and it has nothing to do with the smarter planning per se. There are two control points around this queue by the dispatcher. There's one control point before the queue. So what does it do is gatekeeping. Whenever requests come in before, so what it does, it look into the request and see what it is, and then put it into the queue. And there are different kinds of queue, and there are different types of requests put into different kinds of queues. For example, lightweight requests will go to the synchronous request queue. I will describe why it's called synchronous. And then the long-running heavyweight request will go to the asynchronous request queue. Okay. However, we have the dispatcher has an option to reject the request upfront. That is the case when this dispatcher knows that some component manager is in trouble, meaning that some component right now is failed or it's being repaired at the point. Then there is no reason you actually put those requests put into the queue and actually give some uncertainty to the users in terms of response. So those cases, it just reject right away. And from the experience, we found that it's always better say no early rather than just wait and see what happens and nothing happens and you confuse the customers. And also when, so this, the gatekeeping, in this gatekeeping work, when it puts the request into the right queue, it can set different types of variables. when is it time to leave, there is some request requiring some sensitive response time, and you set the time to leave there. Also, the request can be stamped with the priority. So for example, basically there are two kinds of requests, not the short time or the long time. There is a request coming from the users, and there are requests coming from another component manager. Here, we do not allow direct communication between components. So we do not allow instance manager talk to the image manager, give me your image, because of pluggability and extensibility. So those requests still also comes through the same gate, and those internal requests should have a higher priority than the new external request, because we can have a deadlock if we just let the new request coming in and internal requests and sitting in the queue. So the second point of control is below the queue. So when the requests in the queue are processed, they can be processed differently based on the priority and other things, right? And I told you that there are two different kinds of queue, synchronous and asynchronous. So synchronous queue, the requests come into the synchronous queue, and in most of the cases, it's just forwarded immediately to the component manager. Its response comes back within a second or something, and then that response is forwarded back to the user. The asynchronous request, for example, create instance, that's going to take minutes. But this HTTP request should be responded earlier than that. So what happens is we actually start forward the request to the component manager, in that case, instance manager. But at the same time, it returns, respond to the user, say, we started it. And then when the request is completed, we actually create the event to notify the user again. Okay, where the smartness coming from? Why do we call it smart? So we provide the request forward throttling, which means we can slow down the rate. We move the request down to the component manager, and we do this based on the feedback. This is similar to the work presented by the prior two present speakers. So what it does, so let me explain it with one example. And this throttling model is based on constraints, status, and policy. For example, the instance manager, as I mentioned before, there is some kind of concurrent capacity limit. Only up to 256 instance creation can happen at the same time. So this is reported to the dispatcher, so dispatcher understands that limit. But at the same time, then, this dispatcher needs to know how many requests are currently being processed. So this can be monitored through the transaction manager. And transaction manager is not necessarily providing, like, database transaction. It just provides a way to keep track of the status of request, where it is processed in this system. And then also it can check the outstanding request already waiting to be processed by the instance manager, so the dispatcher can calculate how many instance creations are going on at the same time. And if there are more requests coming, it can make a decision whether it move it down or it just to hold it. And I talked about constraints and status. Also, the user or the component provider can set the policy that I want to have like 10% safety buffer. Then even if before it reaches 256, the dispatcher will throttling down the request forwarding. Okay, so I'll go over each component manager one by one. I will just try to give a brief overview. If you have questions on specifics or details, you can take a look at the paper. But if you send me that request, forward that email to the right person who can answer. So image manager. So what image manager does, if you listen to this talk, you can get an idea that I can create the whole system which can provide infrastructure as a service. Image manager catalogs, accesses, and maintains virtual machines. And let me give you a selection of operations that can be done through Image Manager. So list image just give you a list of images you can use. That includes public images available and private images that you created. Describe image will give you information, all information about image, who's the owner, et cetera, et cetera. But the two most important operations here are checkout image and check-in image. So checkout image retrieves the requested image from the image repository and actually shape into the right form and move it into the place located, in this case it's a directory URL, so that instance manager can talk to the hypervisor to start the VM based on that. And so as indicated by my description, this checkout image is not really used by the user, it's called by instance manager. And check-in image is the opposite. Check-in image actually requests to take a snapshot of running virtual machine and put it into the right shape and stick that into the repository. And there are other operations like deprecate image, like a deleting image, and publish and unpublish. Publish means I want to share my image with others so others can create the instance based on my image. And this image information contains not only contains the snapshot of the root disk, but also it contains the metadata, including name, description, who's the owner, also the access control list, like what is the group of people who can access this image for check-in or check-out. Also, it contains the parent ID, and I will describe why it has the parent ID. Parent ID is used to maintain the provenance. So what is a provenance? Provenance is you keep track of your parent and child relationships. You can have some kind of tree-type hierarchy. And this is very useful. Let me compare this to the conventional image library. Conventional image library, you just take a snapshot of root disk and then make it as one file and stick it into the storage. Okay? And then so because of that, it doesn't really maintain any kind of information for the relationship between different images. There are relationships. So it's very hard to compress. There is a way to deduplicate, but it's far more complicated. On the other hand, our Mirage image library, which is a name for our image manager, maintains the parent-child relationship. Because most of cases, you start with a certain image, and you modify it, meaning you install some software, and you create own image to make your own. And most of the root file systems stay exactly the same. Only small set of files affected by that are different. So those are dips. And by maintaining this provenance information, also structuring image data based on the file, instead of just big chunk of image, you can actually save a lot of space. So this is more like a dip-based compression technique. And there is also another big advantage because you maintain these files in the image level, you can actually manipulate this image without mounting it to the file system or creating an instance out of it. And I will give you one example how it was exploited. Instance manager creates the instance out of image, starts the instance, stops the instance, and destroys the instance. And stopping instance and destroying instance are different. Stopping means just shut it down the VM instance. Destroying means also get rid of all the resources, including IP address and disk space and et cetera. Instance manager, mostly what it does is actually it follows the steps required to set up an instance or destroy an instance. And this can be done through some simple scripting. So in most of administration of the software, they just do it through the script. However, there is a lot of issue doing with the script. So in this case, we use some workflow engine. So you actually specify the steps, and you specify the dependency, and actually many of them can be done concurrently. And if there is something happens in between, it knows how to roll back and then resume. And here is a list of things that are done to create an instance. First, it reserves all the resources. So when you create instance, you make sure that you have a disk space for that, and you make sure that there is a host where you can create one instance, or you make sure that there is IP address you can use, and you reserve them all. And the reason you reserve all of this upfront is to prevent deadlock. You don't want to take some resources and request later and then realize that resource is not available. Then it actually requests the image manager. I think I mentioned before. Ask the image manager, just give me your instance and put it in the right place in the right form. Then it actually picks up some files. There is some customization needed for some files. For example, user can request to create the instance with a specific SSH keys as a separate information, and this SSH keys should need to be stick into this a certain file. But you cannot customize everything just manipulating files. So we added something called activation engine. Activation engine is a code which will be run at the first boot. For example, some setup for the DHCP to get the IP address actually will be entered into the activation engine. Then just talk to the hypervisor. This is a VM you will start and trigger it to start and wait until it finishes. An activation engine will run automatically as one of the scripts run at the boot time. And everything will be set, and instance manager wait and then until it finishes. When it finishes, it notifies the users, your instance is available. So we use some system called Vega for instance management or provisioning management. And this software was also designed such a way that it provides the one single abstraction for the instance management, but it can handle all different kinds of servers in the back or all different kinds of hypervisors. So this, the way it is done is the workflow is considered as kind of driver. So you can have all different kinds of drivers for different kinds of system in the back. Okay, security. Because we cannot solve all the security problems in the cloud, we actually provide a way to harden the virtual machines in the cloud system. The way we do is we provide something called trusted virtual domain. With a trusted virtual domain, the virtual machine users or cloud customers can specify what kind of traffic can come to their virtual machines from outside world, like the internet. Also, they can specify what kind of communication are allowed between two different virtual domains. Within the same virtual domain, it's like a local area network. Everything may be allowed and everything can be set by the for the each instance of maybe Linux. And let me explain about it with one example. So here is an example with two trusted virtual domain, or we call it security domain. One is blue and one is pink. And with the security domain A, there are two virtual machines. And also there are two virtual machines for the domain B. So one we can specify is that we only allow the SSH traffics from the outside world into this domain. Then everything in terms of like IP tables, EB tables will be set correctly to enforce that. The second is also I can specify in the virtual domain, virtual trusted domain B, that I only accept traffics from the domain A for port 80. I think port 80 is HTTP web traffics. So this means that with all other virtual domains, no traffic will be able to reach. Okay? So you can specify that, for example, you may have some partnership with other cloud customers and companies, and there is some transaction should happen for some business operations, right? Then you have to specify this to allow those traffics. And this enforcement through the EB tables and IP tables actually prevent the spoofing at the IP level and above. Chargeback. There is not much technical thing about chargeback, but this is interesting. I said we want to have a realistic infrastructure as a service cloud environment, right? When you implemented, designed and implemented all these functionalities, people were happy and started using all of them, right? The problem is that lots of people are creating instances and never delete any of them because it's free. So what happens is you have an experiment to run the 100 VMs for Hadoop type of workloads for some kind of data mining. They create 100 instances from one image and they are happy because it happens in parallel. And they run some workloads, and when they're done, they're supposed to delete them. But they just keep them there just in case I may need to run again for different results, etc. Never touch again, stays there. So one way is you identify those idle instances and notify them. Could you just delete them? But that's not a nice way. Maybe that's a nicer way, but the best way is you use the economy. You set the price for it. Okay, nobody wants to pay for nothing. So we set the chargeback system inside, and this is not the credit card based because we don't have to do that. But this collects the information of usage here through the event. So the events are created for the charge-related operations. For example, start instance and stop instance, you can actually calculate the VM hours used. Also, image capturing, which costs a lot of resources, so there is a charge for that. And those informations are reported into some data store through the XML format. And our existing business support system, which is doing the fund transfer between the departments. I don't know what they do, but the money goes between the different departments, actually handles this charge. So what happens is you started some workload with 100 instances and living there. It's going to consume this. It's going to be charged, then maybe your manager will come back and there is a $20,000 charge. What happens, right? Then you'll be more careful how to use this. And this is important because that is the way cloud computing makes sense. And that is the right behaviors we are expecting, right? Cloud computing, you want to just pay as you go, only as much as you want, right? If there is no need for that, you don't want to pay for it, so you want to get rid of it. So this is just an interesting chart with what happens. So from the beta release, the instance usage was increasing linearly and sometimes almost exponentially. But the date, you see the red line is the date we announced that there will be charge. And you see this plumbing in terms of instance usage and the surge in terms of instance deletions, that they are worried that the department will be charged and there will be nagged in terms of waste of resources, etc. Then we were worried that, okay, what if nobody uses cloud? Then there is no playground. But also there is another reason we want to exercise cloud economy and the pricing scheme. So what happens? We change the pricing scheme and see what happens. If the cloud computing doesn't make sense, people just purchase the department just purchase the capital machine, they use it. Then we have to somehow adjust to find the right point for the pricing. Fortunately, after some trials, the usage started going up back to the normal. And how much time do I have? 2 minutes. So there were a couple more challenges, and this is one challenge that, okay, now there are researchers, I need to run my workload on AIX, on P-series, right? It would be nice I can just grab the AIX ARPA instances from the cloud and run my workload just like Linux groups. Okay, so we wanted to support it, so we implemented it, and this one just shows that provisioning instances like a virtual machine, or they call it ARPA in AIX, in power systems are very different from you taking a virtual image snapshot and creating instance out of it. But we were able to handle it within the instance manager without affecting anywhere else. Okay? So you use exactly the same interface to take a snapshot of image, also create the AirPort instances out of it. And the second strategy, the challenge we had is that, this is interesting, we designed and implemented everything, and for the interface, the servers, we used the Zen as a hypervisor. And a few months later, IBM strategically decided to move from Zen to KVM because Zen Source was acquired by a company, then it's not open source anymore, okay? The problem is we already had so many customers, I mean the users, researchers, and already made lots of images, and we're not going to run the Zen anymore. We cannot say, sorry, all your images you created in Zen cannot be run on our cloud anymore. That's not acceptable. I said the commercial-grade cloud, and you cannot make that kind of excuse. So we had to convert all these Zen-based images to the KVM, and thanks to the Mirage library, which can manipulate files in the image without creating instances, we were able to actually convert all of them. We have maybe at the time have about 600 images successfully with a very short time and with small usage of storage. So this is just showing some graphs of the popularity of RC2. It's growing very well. So in terms of instances, also in terms of images, the reason I'm showing images grow is that it's not that like only a small number of images used for hundreds or thousands of instances like Hadoop. It's also lots of people trying different kinds of workloads, creating their own images and run their different types of instances. And here is a memory capacity chart. The reason I'm showing memory capacity is that not CPU, the memory is the bottleneck in terms of how many VMs you want to run in one physical host. Maybe as many of you already know. So in the beginning, the memory actually uses saturated around 80%, 90%. And the dip is around the time we had a chargeback. And then it goes back up, and it plumbs again because we added more machines because we need more capacity. And it goes back up and goes down. After that point, whenever it goes down, it's either the time period of a department billing, or we added more machines into the pool. People are sensitive about their money. So this is not the real money. This is IBM blue money. We don't really know money really going between the departments or not. So I think this concludes my talk. And if there are any questions, I will be happy to take an answer.
So speaking of open source software, are you releasing any of this at all?
Are we releasing this? The Mirage Image Manager, I think, is at least we make it public. I don't think we will release the whole infrastructure software as open source or make it public, but some components are available. For example, the Vega Image Manager will not be released as open source or the public, but that Mirage Image Manager, I think it's available in public, or it will be available in public as a library. So you can just take that, and if you use it, implement your own infrastructure service, maybe for private cloud, you can just take that to fill the gap for the image management. And that's the answer for the, like, can we really release the software? The another thing is then, can you let others use our cloud? So there are lots of discussion. We created some gray zone where some of the selected researchers with some academic relationship can access our cloud and create instances and do things like Amazon EC2. But I don't know, maybe there will be some expansions for the academic researchers, but I doubt that we will make this cloud available for other industries. However, IBM already introduced our own infrastructure as a service offering, which is not necessarily available to everybody, which is available to selected customers.
Are you allowing guests that don't use the paravirtualized drivers?
Paravirtualized drivers for what, Gen?
KVM.
I don't think we use. I that details I don't know.
Okay.
So thank you.
I try to answer the last question. I think we use that emulator drivers, if that makes sense, instead of the paravirtualized the ones. The emulation of drivers? That we are looking at it, and at this point, we are not hardening at that those component level of a security yet.
All right, thank you.
We get away with it because it's only available within IBM.
Right. So it's all.
So if you're hackers, if you have hackers inside IBM, yeah, that's a problem.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.